doing it, huh?
Was a great movie with Christopher Walken and Dennis Hopper, and Christopher Walken is going to kill Dennis Hopper, so Dennis Hopper gives him that spiel about the Sicilians. it's a great scene, I'll tell you. Sorry, I don't remember the title of the movie, but I'm sure you could find it on YouTube or something. White Aryan Resistance Radio Network calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, in the bunker. Getting ready with my popcorn and peanuts for the big debate tonight. Woo-wee! Is Trump going to show up or ain't he? We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And our big website, which is going back up right as we speak, slowly but surely, resist.com. And we're going to have a lot of more new stuff on there, too. And I'm working on this video thing. I'd like to put out at least a half an hour video show, too. I got a new program on there, and so we're going to work on that, too. And I hope you all got your donations in. Yeah, we need some of those donations. I think most of you got them in. But you better, because if you don't, I got to cut you off, baby. Edit you out. This whole Republican-Trump thing is getting just totally out of hand. It is wilder than hell. They don't know what. They don't know how to crap or go blind, man. I'll tell you. But I'll tell you what my theory is about this, and I think it's probably very true. You see, the last election with that idiot McCain, who nobody cared about voting for, and half of the country didn't vote. Half of the country usually doesn't vote, but millions of people don't vote. And they got no reason, good reason to vote for jerks like McCain. Well, I think a few of the Republican hierarchy guys put Trump up to this. And yeah, they need to reinvigorate the party and get people out to vote. And it takes something really wild to get them out to vote. So I think this is the scam that's going to get them out to vote. Whether he wins or not, it's going to get a lot of people voting Republican and registering Republican. I think that's what the whole scam's about. Could be wrong, but I'm usually not. Usually not. But I don't think they thought that it would take off like this. I don't think anybody thought that it would take off like this. But Iowa's going to be tromped over like you wouldn't believe this evening and the next couple of days. Well, let's get going here with reading from the glorious Book of War. This is the humorous kind. Want to know about restaurants? There are certain clues that tell you how much a restaurant will cost. If the word cuisine appears in the advertising, it will be expensive. If they use the word food, it will be moderately priced. However, if the sign says eats, even though you'll save some money on food, your medical bills may be quite high. I don't like trendy food. When I hear sautéed boneless panda groin, I know I'm in the wrong place. There's such a thing as pretentious food. Puree of woodchuck, marinated bat nipples, weasel chops, and porcupine cacciatore. Or fried eagle. A guy said to me recently, "Come on, we'll go to Baxter's. They have some really great fried eagle." I'm thinking to myself, do I really want to know this guy? However, if you're going to dine with pretentious people, here are some of the items you can order that are sure to impress. Deep dish moose balls, diced yak, badger gumbo, gorilla fondue, filet of hyena, jackal tartare, rack of prairie dog, free-range mole and brochette, wolf noodle soup, loin of chipmunk, curried woodpecker, stir-fried weasel, penguin scallopini, sweet and sour loon heads, whale chowder, toasted snail penises, koala flambé, wombat souvlaki, grenadine of mule, and candied goat anus. Then at the other end of the spectrum, there's the decidedly non-trendy restaurant, where the special sometimes is simply meat. Big sign in the window, today's special, meat. I'll have meat. Would you like sauce with that? What kind of sauce would that be? That would be meat sauce. It's similar to a fish sandwich. Have you ever seen these places that feature fish sandwiches? I always think, well, what kind of... That's kind of general. I mean, I wouldn't order something called a meat sandwich, would you? At least not without a couple of follow-up questions. Does anyone know where this meat came from? Are any of the waitresses missing? Well, let's spend the rest of our Thursday with Jack London, the book I was reading yesterday, and Herbert Spencer, the father of really Might Makes Right, or Survival of the Fittest. So here we go again. Throughout the book, A Daughter of the Snows, a mutual attraction exists between Frona and Vance Corliss. Corliss proved the ideal mate for Frona. In Corliss, some atavism had been at work in the making of him, and he had reverted to that ancestor who sturdily uplifted. Spencer wrote atavism, which is the same name given to the recurrence of ancestral traits, is proved by many and varied facts. The issue of acquired characteristics and survival of the fittest reappeared in Call of the Wild. Instead of recasting a woman as the carrier of superior genetics, London metaphorically used the canine world in the place of the human. The dog Buck inherited his size and weight from his St. Bernard father, but it was his Scotch Shepherd mother who had given shape to that size and weight. In the study of sociology, Spencer wrote, "Children bear likenesses to their progenitors in character and capacity." In the 1892 American edition of Social Statics, Spencer went a step further. Consumptive parents with lungs incompetent to perform the duties of lungs, people with digestive organs that will not take up enough nutrient, people with defective hearts which break down under effort, people with any continual flaw preventing due fulfillment of the conditions of life are continually dying out and leaving behind those fit for the climate, food, and habits for which they are born. As the Frona Wells, Buck inherited the genes best suited for the Klondike's environment, and therefore he survived. But Buck's inheritance went beyond his physical attributes to include the intellectual. Buck's pride in his superior strength and mental prowess communicated itself like a contagion to his physical being. While she crossed through the Klondike wilderness, Frona admired two huge, strapping, blonde-haired giants, each striding along with 100 pounds on his back. In similar fashion, Frona felt the call of her race when confronted with the various physical dangers. Nature's unfortunate specimens, the genetically inferior races, and the mongrels fared less well in London's Klondike. In The Comparative Psychology of Man, Spencer wrote that the mixture of human races extremely unalike produces a worthless type of mind, fitted neither for the kind of life led by the higher of the two races, nor that led by the lower. Improving this point, Spencer cited natural laws in the animal kingdom which prevented crossbreeding and the work of Francis Galton, the father of eugenics. London recited the similar sentiments in The Call of the Wild. To Buck's consternation, his owners refreshed the exhausted sled team with short-haired pointers a Newfoundland, and two mongrels of indeterminate breed. Hampered by their poor inheritance and lack of breeding, the new dogs proved useless to the rest of the team. After reading Darwin in the Klondike, London came back to California fortified with ideas of natural and sexual selection. While courting Bess Madden, his woman, he met through a mutual friend, London wrote to Johns that we are all blind factors in the actions of natural selection among the races of men. Frohna also believed in the natural selection and sexual selection. While he wrote about a Spencerian superwoman, he wedded a woman he thought the incarnation of Frohna Welse. In April 1900, London married Bess, a sturdy woman of good Anglo-Saxon stock. With Bess, London believed he would raise a brood of healthy Anglo-Saxon children. The day before London married Bess, he sent a letter to a brilliant socialist and close friend, Anna Strunsky. London wrote, "For 1,000 reasons, I think myself justified in making this marriage. It will not interfere much with my old life or my life as I plan for the future. It could be said that Spencer's officiated my wedding and my marriage of London and Bess. More a mating match than a love match." During London's first year of marriage, he justified his marriage through a series of letters to Anna Strunsky. They jointly published as the Kempton Weiss Letters. The Kempton Weiss Letters consisted of a series of correspondences between two imaginary men, Herbert Weiss and Dane Kempton. London played the part of the Weiss, a young student from the University of California, and Anna the part of Kempton, an English poet living in London. Their debate centered around the primacy of eugenics, or the selective breeding, over romantic love. London argued that marriage, considered biological, is an institution necessary for the perpetuation of the species. In Principles of Ethics, 1879 to 1893, Spencer wrote, "It must be admitted that any treatment of self which furthers body or mental development tends towards the benefit of the next generation." Spencer also referred to this process as race maintenance. With this in mind, Weiss described his fiancée. "She has health and strength and beauty and youth. She will certainly make a most charming wife and excellent mother. I am proud of her, too, and proud of myself, that so fine a creature should find enough in me to be willing to mate with me." London hoped for much the same in his own life, while Strunsky, as Kempton, continued to stress the importance of love and marriage. London stressed the woman's role in obedient mother of the race. London agreed with Spencer's assertion that the primary duty of women is the welfare of posterity. While they collaborated on the Kempton Weiss letters, London and Strunsky wrote each other almost daily. More than a year into the marriage, London wrote to Strunsky, "Why did I write to you? It is so inadequate, so incoherent. I am brimming over. I could talk all night to you, and yet the half would not be told." A year later, London woefully regretted that 10,000 generations separated them. Earlier, before his marriage to Bess, London discounted any sexual relationship with Strunsky because of her Russian Jewish heritage. With great difficulty, as was the case of Jenny Prentice, London resolved the incompatibility of his philosophical beliefs with the reality of his world by remaining silent, though anti-Semitism became a strong aspect of racial rhetoric. London infrequently wrote disdainfully about the Jewish people. In May 1903, as Macmillan released the Kempton Waste letters, London's Spencerian marriage unraveled. Though the marriage looked good in theory, London realized he needed someone that was more than just a baby producer. During his separation, London intensified his relationship with Charmaine Kitteridge. While visiting Charmaine at her aunt Netta's home in Glen Ellen, London started to work on his novel Seawolf. As in The Call of the Wild, London incorporated Spencer's survival of the fittest motif into the Seawolf. The plot of the book revolved around the struggle between Humphrey Van Weyden, a San Francisco author, and Wolf Larsen, the ghost Nietzschean captain, the epitome of Nietzsche's Übermensch. Through self-education, Larsen acquired a vast knowledge of poetry, philosophy, and even Spencer. In conversation with Larsen, the name of Herbert Spencer comes up. Van Weyden cried, "Spencer, have you read him?" Larsen responds, "Not very much." Herein lies Wolf Larsen's major flaw. As Weyden and Larsen continued their discussion of Spencer, they came to Spencer's philosophy of altruism. Years earlier, London discussed the very same subject with Klosky Johns. Larsen correctly described Spencer's altruism. Spencer puts it something like this: first, a man must act for his own benefit. To do this is to be moral and good. Next, he must act for the benefit of his children. The third, he must act for the benefit of his race. Van Weyden responded, "And the higher, finest, right conduct is the act which benefits at the same time the man, his children, and his race." Larsen completely rejected Spencer's concern for one's progeny and one's race. Larsen believed only in himself. When Maud Brewster entered into the picture, Van Weyden stuck with the Spencerian concerns of the race, while Larsen continued his adherence to the instincts of the savage primitive. On the subject of sexes, Spencer wrote, "Just as certainly as they have physical differences, which are related to the respective parts they play in the maintenance of the race, so contained have they physical differences, similarly related to their respective shares in the rearing and protection of offspring." Van Weyden recognized his genetic duty to Maud Brewster and to the race. As London described in his letter with Johns regarding Spencerian altruism, Van Weyden heard the call of the blood. Marooned on an inhospitable island after their escape from the clutches of Larsen, Van Weyden acknowledged the resurfacing of his own race heritage. He first observed the phenomenon of Wolf Larsen. Larsen's race heritage only surfaced the primal melancholy of the race. As opposed to Larsen, Van Weyden's race heritage stemmed from Spencer. As often the case in London's novel, racial awareness coincided with the development of bodily masculinity in the male. Van Weyden boarded the Seawolf as a flabby, over-pampered bookworm. Van Weyden's doctors once told him of his remarkable constitution, which he never developed through exercise. By the same Maud, during the joined the voyage, Van Weyden's muscles grew harder and increased in size on the island. Van Weyden's renewed physical strength and racial heritage burgeoned inside him. Van Weyden thought, "I shall never forget in the moment how instantly conscious I became of my manhood. The primitive deeps in my nature stirred. I felt myself masculine, the protector of the weak, the fighting male. And best of all, I felt myself the protector of my loved one. I lived for myself the hunting days and the forest nights of my remote and forgotten ancestry." This theory evolved from Spencer, who wrote that nature secures the growth of a race, which insists on both physical and mental fitness. With Larson, London created an anomaly. Larson owned a beautiful masculine body. He was almost a god in his perfectness, but his mind contained no regard for the race. London intended the anomaly of Larson. London wrote the sea wolf was an attack on the Superman philosophy of Nietzsche. Larson's servitude to Nietzsche destroyed any possible manifestation of racial altruism. Misinterpreted by many as a racialist, Nietzsche once wrote, "The Aryan influence has corrupted all the world." And that's a good point for all those people out there who keep yapping about Nietzsche. The Aryan influence has corrupted all the world. Needing a watertight material for the roof of their new hut, Van Weyden and Maud wandered into the writhing harem of seals, while Van Weyden stalked some unsuspecting seal. Maud recalled a book by Jordan she once read. According to Maud, Jordan says the paths are left between the harems, just as Van Weyden argued over Spence with Larson. Van Weyden and Maud, who both heralded the San Francisco Bay Area, discussed David Starr Jordan, the first president of the Leland Stanford University. David Starr Jordan introduced many of the racist ideologies of Europe to the United States, and especially to California. And that was the end of that chapter. Let's see what we've got here. The next chapter, we go into eugenics and racial memories. Jack London meets David Starr Jordan. A year following the publication of Herbert Spencer's first book, Social Statics, David Starr Jordan was born to Hiram Jordan, a rural New York State farmer with a fondness for New England transcendentalism, and Huldah Lake Hawley, a distant cousin of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Though formally educated during childhood, both London and Jordan tended towards self-education. As boys, both read broadly from science and adventure novels, and they shared a love for Charles Dickens and Rudyard Kipling. At age 18, Jordan entered Cornell University on a scholarship in 1869. 3 years later, he graduated with the degree of Bachelor of Science. At the same time, since he completed the requirements, Jordan also received his master's degree in botany. He entitled his master's thesis, quote, "The Wildflowers of the Wyoming Country," unquote. In 1879, Jordan received his first major appointment as a professor of natural history at Indiana University. He taught courses in botany, geology, physiology, and zoology. During his tenure at Indiana, Jordan continued his interest in ichthyology, I-C-H-T-H-Y-O-L-O-G-Y. I've never seen that before. And in 1881, he successfully climbed the Matterhorn. Jordan was offered the presidency of the university at age 33, which he accepted in 1885. Isn't it interesting how some of these super intellectual or advanced thinkers are also physically superior, climbing mountains and all that kind of stuff? By 1891, Jordan's reputation was such that Leland Stanford chose the now 40-year-old educator to assume the presidency of his newly founded university. Many Easterners scoffed at Stanford, a former U.S. senator and railroad magnate. for building a university in the sparsely populated fields of Palo Alto, California, a small hamlet south of San Francisco. Palo Alto lay across the Bay of San Francisco from the well-established University of California at Berkeley. Soon after its founding, the young faculty Jordan amassed, and the university emphasis on mental and physical development drew students to California from the East Coast. One student, when asked why he chose Stanford, said he admired the university's progressive educational ideas. He admired them. With two major universities, the Bay Area solidified its position as one of the major intellectual centers in the country. In his autobiography, The Days of Man, being memories of a naturalist, teacher, and minor prophet of democracy in 1922, Jordan recalled his first meeting with Jack London. Though Jordan specified no date for the meeting, it was likely occurred during London's first semester at the University of California. Jordan wrote, quote, "I first met him in Oakland as an attendant at my university extension course on evolution. He was then a sticky young fellow of great physical strength and endurance as well as of decided individuality. Being much interested in the subject of my lectures, he became in some degree an intellectual disciple. In 1898, Jordan collected his lectures on evolution, along with the essays of three other evolutionary theorists, two of whom taught at Stanford University. In Footnotes on Evolution, a series of popular addresses on the evolution of life, 1898. On April 30, 1899, London wrote a letter to Cloudesley Johns in which he mentioned his familiarity with Jordan's book. 3 months later, his affection for Jordan deepened. "He is so clean and broad and wholesome," London wrote. "Would to God he were duplicated in 1,000 times in the U.S. Before publishing Footnotes to Evolution, Jordan's previous books covered various topics on the North American animal life, which included the exhaustive volumes of Fishes of North and Middle America, 1896, and his personal address to the best and truest of men and women, The Care and Culture of Men, a series of addresses on higher education, 1896. In Footnotes of To Evolution, Jordan unequivocally stated his belief in the Spencerian theories of acquired characteristics and the survival of the fittest. Jordan wrote, "The fittest by which organisms have been perpetuated is simply obedience to adaptation. Those which survive are fitted to the conditions of life." Though Spencer discussed issues of race maintenance years earlier, Jordan introduced the European-based philosophy of eugenics to the United States. Francis Galton, a cousin of Charles Darwin, had modified Spencer's theories of race maintenance into eugenics movement. Galton described eugenics as the science of improving stock, which is by no means confined to questions of judicious mating, but which, especially in the case of man, takes cognizance of all influences that tend, however remote a degree, to give more suitable races or strains of blood a better chance of prevailing speedily over the less suitable. One of the first American scholars to promote eugenics principles, Jordan introduced London to Galton's theories. Through Jordan, London gained a rudimentary knowledge of eugenics, which he successfully incorporated into the Kempton-Wallace letters. Spencer referred to Galton in The Principles of Sociology and the Comparative Physiology of Man, but he mainly cited Galton's non-eugenics work, Narrative of an Explorer in Tropical South Africa, 1853. Thus, London's first exposure to Galton's eugenics came through Jordan's Footnotes to Evolution, even before London moved to the Glen Ellen area of Sonoma County, where he experimented with animal husbandry. London used animal breeding and analogies in reference to eugenics. In the Kempton Wace letters, for example, London went beyond the rudimentary eugenics principles of Spencer to include the more specific breeding codes developed by Galton and Jordan. London, writing as the fictional Herbert Wace, described the actions of the stock breeder. Does he wish horses which are fast? He selects the fastest. He studies the physics and velocity in relation to equine locomotion, and with an eye to withers, loins, hocks, and haunches, he segregates the brood mares and his stallions, and behold, in the course of a few years, he has a thoroughbred stock, swifter of foot than any ever in the world before. Less than a month later, London sent another letter in which he praised Jordan's book, The Care and Culture of Men. As London wrote in the Kempton Wace letters, Jordan also compared non-human breeding with eugenics. Jordan wrote, "Florists save the seed of their fairest flowers, that from the species." May reach still higher perfection. Stock breeders recognize that individual gains are inherited, and they choose their stock accordingly. So we have year by year swifter racehorses, better milk cows, and pigeons of more fantastic forms. As horse breeders selectively choose their studs and mares, humans should do the same when choosing a mate. In Footnotes to Evolution and the Kempton Wace letters, Jordan and London did not refer to the issue of miscegenation. That would come later. Like Spencer, Jordan combined an interest in physical fitness with eugenics. Jordan repeatedly stressed the need for good health. Without health, the noblest of inherited genes prove useless. In Footnotes to Evolution, Jordan wrote, "Just as a sound mind demands a sound body, so does a sound child demand a sound mother." Bad nutrition, before as well as after birth, may neutralize the most vigorous inheritance. Even the physical weaknesses of the father transmitted to the developing fetus handicapped the hereditary strength. Successful reproduction not only needed a fit woman, but a physically fit man. Though plagued with various illnesses till his untimely death, London often prided himself in his physical culturalist body. As London read Jordan, the entire country, London included idolized boxers and physical culturalist gurus. During his residence in Oakland, London often visited the local athletic club for calisthenics and swimming. He continued his exercise regimen with boxing and swimming after his 1905 move to Glen Ellen. An accomplished physical culturalist himself, Jordan dedicated an entire book, The Strength of Being Clean, 1900, to the subject of health and exercise. For Jordan and London, the strong must mate with the strong. As often was the case of London's life, what he read made it a way of his life. London based his marriage to Bess Mattern on the Spencerian principles of survival of the fittest, but also on eugenics. An athletic woman on a whim, Bess once bicycled with London for 40 to 50 miles. When he saw as her sound heredity attracted London, a similar relationship to that of London and Bess appeared in A Daughter of the Snows book, attracted to the well-mustached Vance Corliss. Frona felt impelled to joy at the well-built frame and well-shaped muscle. Why should she restrain? Why should she not love the body and without shame? The history of the race and off all races sealed her choice with approval. Down all time, the weak and the effeminate males had vanished from the world stage. Only the strong could inherit the earth. In 1899, London wrote to Johns, "The female is the passive, the male the active factor in carrying on the function of reproduction. Yet in lower forms of life, the female is far larger than the male. She it is who pursues the resisting male, that she may breed her kind. This followed Jordan, who drew heavily from Schopenhauer, that women primarily exist for the continuation of the species. London first explored the relationship between eugenics and the physically fit male in his sociological study of the London slums, The People of the Abyss, 1903. In The People of the Abyss, London described the body of a young man with a physique very similar to Billy's. London bunked with the young man for a night. When they stripped for bed, London was in awe. Born into poverty and misery, the young man owned the body of a god. After seeing his beautiful body, London soured for his splendid racial type. Doomed to rack and ruin and to pass hence without posterity, to receive the splendid heritage it was his to bequeath. The sorry plight of this young man agreed with Jordan, who wrote in Footnotes to Evolution, quote, "To be born but brought up in the slums means to be born to premature death." This idea corresponded with Spencer's as well. In Martin's Eden, London, wrote the nature rejected the true child of the ghetto. During the physical cultural craze, the most successful physical culturalist guru founded sanitariums in the unblemished countryside. By far the most famous sanitariums, founded by Bernard McFadden, promised a purer and nobler type of manhood and womanhood, and for the annihilation of those weaknesses, evils, and vice, which are the outcome of a civilization which is entirely at variance with our normal instincts and promptings of Mother Nature. In the tragic love story, The Game, 1905, London took the idea further. A relatively short and ambitious story, The Game incorporated both boxing and eugenic attraction among two physically superior mates, drawn to each other by their physical beauty. A handsome, well-muscled boxer appealed to the eugenic sensibility of the young woman. Joe and Genevieve were the working-class aristocrats. All of the young men in Genevieve's neighborhood stood in awe of her, but she only had eyes for her eugenic equal. For the woman, the masculinity of the fighting male made it inevitably appeal to her. A female, molded by her heredity to seek out the strong man for a mate. In the audience at her first boxing match, Genevieve saw her lover's near-naked body for the first time. While looking at his beautiful body, she could hear the clamor of the children unborn. Tragically, the young boxer, killed in the ring by a swarthy, hair-covered brute, never passed on his genetic heritage. The main characteristics in London's intriguing Back to the Farm novel, The Valley of the Moon, shared a concern for both physical culture and eugenics, both healthy and beautiful. And two of the main characters, Billy and Saxon Roberts, encapsulated the best of the sturdy Saxon breed. Billy, a handsome, muscular boxer, radiates the muscular grace when Saxon first notices him at a picnic. But the stress of city life soon took their toll on Billy's body. He began to drink, arrive home late, get into fights with scabs. The conditions of the urban poor, Jordan agreed, led to reduced vitality, lowered morality, and loss of self-respect. Desperate for some cash, Billy re-enters the ring, even though he promised Saxon never to box again. Pulverized into a bloody mass of bruised flesh, the physical culturalist that attracted Saxon to Billy is gone. Soon after losing their firstborn unborn child, Billy snaps. In a blind rage, Billy beats up a man Saxon was boarding for extra money. Miserable in the unhealthy environment of the city, Saxon proposes that they leave the city, moving southwards. And Roberts passed various farms and small towns. They continue south with everything they own strapped to their backs, eventually arriving in a seaside town of Carmel during their stay in Carmel. Billy and Saxon meet Jim Hazard, an ex-football player turned novelist and father. They first spot him on the beach. He was smooth and rosy skinned, cherubic faced, with a thatched and curly yellow hair, but his body was hugely thewed as Hercules. London compares the Hazard immense build with the likes of George Hackenschmidt and Eugene Sandow, who's graced pages of physical culture magazines and pioneered techniques in weightlifting and exercise. In Carmel, Billy and Saxon become friends with other physical culture advocates. Astonished at the robust health and beauty of those they encounter, Billy remarks, "Everybody down here seems to go for physical culture." Billy and Hazard quickly from their own private physical culture regime. Each day they box, swim, shower, and rub each other down in the training camp style. Soon Billy's beautiful body returns. London ascribed his return to health after a long bout with alcohol to his playing tag in the swimming pool, flying kites, and riding horses. He also became interested in the relationship between the male-female physical well-being and the sexual potency, mainly through his reading of McFadden's book, The Viral Power of Superb Manhood, written in 1900. With his good health and physique restored, Roberts moves on. After a month of searching, the Roberts settled in the pastoral hills of Glen Ellen. The denouement of the story occurs when Saxon reveals her pregnancy to Billy. In London's life, the same happy ending proved more elusive. With Bess, a robust, red-cheeked girl full of energy, London hoped for seven sturdy Saxon sons and seven beautiful daughters. London wanted a son, but he got a daughter. Over a year later, on October 20, 1902, Bess gave birth to London's second child, a girl named Becky. The following year, London and Bess separated. After the separation, London's relationship with his two daughters wavered from the absentee to the bitterly estranged. Following his divorce, London married Charmaine on November 19, 1905. Charmaine was a woman 5 years his senior, whose small frame belied her incredible physical strength and stamina. During their sometimes torturous cruise through the South Pacific, as the men on board dropped from disease, Charmaine remained relatively well. Charmaine desperately tried to give London the son he so desired, but their first child, a girl, died shortly after birth on June 21, 1910. As Charmaine neared her 42nd birthday in August 1912, fate crushed the London's hopes again when Charmaine miscarried. For these two lovers, the old American stock, love came too late. By 1914, London realized Charmaine would never be his broodmare. The duty of passing on his genetics shifted to Joanne and Becky. Though his two daughters were close in age, London maintained a strong relationship with the more obstinate Joanne following the divorce. He wrote to Joanne intermittently, providing fatherly advice or sanction. In one extraordinary letter written in February 24, 1914, London told Joanne that the genetic gift he bestowed upon her. London wrote, "I have been jealous of my seed, and I have never wantonly scattered my seed. I gave you well, a good body and a good brain." One of Jordan's most fascinating essays, The Heredity of Richard Roe, contained in the footnotes of Evolution, combined eugenics, parental heritage, and racial heritage. The essay centered around a fictional genetic specimen named Richard Roe. Jordan wrote, Richard Roe will follow the race type of his parentage. If he is Anglo-Saxon, all Anglo-Saxon by blood, he will be Anglo-Saxon in quality. To his character of common humanity, he may add those common to the race. In addition, every family of England of strict British descent, English descent, is descended from Alfred the Great. Moreover, there are few, if any, who do not share the blood of William the Conqueror. Jordan based much of his essay on Galton's Hereditary Genius, 1892. In Hereditary Genius, Galton examined the genealogical history of numerous notable men and determined that their genius resulted through the maintenance of a pure Anglo-Saxon stock. Similarly, many of London's Anglo-Saxon heroes and heroines in the Klondike felt the stirrings of long-dead ancestors whirling in their brains. London's men and women burned with pride for their lordly ancestors who fought, killed, and conquered. In the Forest of the North, an intrepid explorer, Avery Van Brunt, pushes into unknown regions of the Northland with the thought that he alone was a full-blooded Saxon and his blood was pounding fiercely through his veins to the traditions of his race. Clive and Hastings, Drake and Raleigh, hence Horsa walked with him. Another one of London's Anglo-Saxon heroes feels the courage of Stockard and Bill and the love of race tradition. As Buck's racial instincts in The Call of the Wild ensured his survival in the harsh environment of the Yukon, the racial memories of the Aryans destined them as a race of doers and fighters, and other racial memories also reawakened dormant Aryan pride. Corliss, whose first doubts Frona's racial philosophy in A Daughter of the Snows, felt strangely that one of the white-skinned, yellow-haired giants of the younger world. London revived the Viking motif in the Valley of the Moon. Saxon Roberts, adrift in the ethnic melting pot of Oakland, admires her husband as a hero, worthy to be that wing-helmeted company leaping from beach boats upon the bloody English sands. In Footnotes to Evolution, Jordan wrote that each individual lives over again in the life of the race. Jordan and London accepted Spencer's theory of Aryan racial homology, but both restricted Aryan classification to the Scandinavian or Northern European races, Jordan wrote. Anglo or Saxon, we were all one blood not many centuries ago. Still farther away, the whole Aryan race becomes one. This distinction clearly appears in London's writings, for he has never included the Latins or the Slavs with the Aryans. Also, in the heredity of Richard Roe, Jordan initiated the theory of racial unconscious. Jordan believed that each individual lives over again the life of the race. Even in his early Klondike stories, the racial unconsciousness appeared as race memories for London's characters. 15 years before London read any of the writings of Carl Jung, his descriptions of racial memories resembled Jung's archetypes. A Yukon Territory judge in the League of Old Men condemns an Indian for the murder of several white men. As he sits in judgment, he dreams, and all his race rose up before him in a mighty phantasmagoria. His steel-shod, mail-clad race, the lawgiver and the world-maker among the families of men. Francis Galton, in Hereditary Genius, attempted to prove that judges passed on judicial characteristics to their descendants. Whether the white man liked it or not, he could not escape the generations. On the same subject, Jordan believed that the past will not let go. London unexpectedly employed racial memories in The Call of the Wild. Along with his strong muscles, thick coat, and instincts for survival, Buck also inherited the whisperings of his ancestors. For Buck, the old longings of his comfortable home in California fell into the bottomless pit of forgotten worlds. In the Klondike, he only knew the memories of his heredity that gave things he had never seen before a seeming familiarity. The instincts with which but the memories of his ancestors became habits. As with the Yukon Territory judge, these memories included visions of the past. As Buck lay about his master's campfire, blinking dreamily at the flames, it seemed that the flames were another fire. By this other fire he saw another and different man from the half-breed cook before him. This other man was shorter of leg and longer of arm, with muscles that were stringy and knotty rather than rounded and swelling. The hair of this man was long and matted, and his head slanted back under it from the eyes. Long before man stood erect, the primitive forefathers of the modern canine sat and stared into the fires of their hairy and slouched Neanderthal sovereigns. Buck re-envisions the past of his race through flashbacks or racial memories that hereditary ingrained in his mind. Jordan wrote that the consciousness of man is not the whole of man. That which made up a man's ego, according to Jordan, included the conscious mind, but also those thoughts inherited from the race. Jordan likened the inherited areas of the ego to the flame that flickers over the embers set on fire long before, and whose burning may go on long after the individual flame has ceased to be. As Buck looks into the fire, he sees his unconscious self, a flame ignited by the charred, shared experiences of his ancestors, now dim with the passage of time. London based his 1907 novel, Before Adam, on Buck's fireside vision of a hairy Neanderthal. London partially borrowed the idea of racial memories or atavism from the works of the author Jordan, repeatedly mentioned in the footnotes to Evolution. August Wiseman, intrigued by Jordan's references to Wiseman, Jordan read the German biologist. Whoop. I knocked my microphone down. Oh, where are we at here? Intrigued by Jordan's references to Wiseman, London read the German biologist's essays upon heredity and kindred biological problems in 1889. Repeating Wiseman's theory of the germplasm, London wrote in Before Adam, "An instinct is a racial memory. Then you and I and all of us receive these memories from our fathers and mothers as they receive them from their fathers and mothers. Therefore, there must be a medium whereby these memories are transmitted from generation to generation. This medium is what Wiseman terms the germplasm. It carries the memories of the whole evolution of the race. These memories are dim and confused, and many of them are lost." It's interesting. The man's name was Wiseman. Could have been Jewish. Could very well have been Jewish. That added quite a bit to the works of Evolution and race memory. London wrote Before Adam nearly 7 years after he first read Wiseman, in part due to his self-education, which included rigorous reading sessions. London developed the remarkable ability to remember the contents of numerous books. He could take one idea from a book he read recently, then another idea from a book he read years earlier, and combine them into a coherent narrative whole. For Before Adam, London took his somewhat dusty volumes of Jordan's footnotes to Evolution, as well as essays upon the heredity and kindred, down from the shelves. Haunted by racial memories of an arboreal creature, the atavist dreamer in Before Adam remembers the life of his most distant ancestor. From Jordan, London learned the homology not only existing in the blood of the Aryan race, but in all races. Jordan wrote, "We are willing in Adam to recognize our homology, even with our poor relations, the Bushmen and the Hottentots." Jordan added, "We know that various races of men and various species of monkeys have sometimes had a common ancestry. The memories of these common ancestor, part man and part ape, became before Adam. By the continued general passing on of germplasm, hereditary traits, and racial memories transmitting themselves down through the ages, yet Wiseman only referred to the sudden reappearance of long-lost characters, not memories." Jordan's footnotes to evolution provided the only known inspiration for racial memories in Before Adam. Within the mind, Jordan explains, lurked memory pictures. These memory pictures crowd the mind, mingling with pictures brought in afresh by the senses. The dreamers of Before Adam experienced the same confused amalgamation of the atavist race memory and self-acquired thoughts. Before the dreamer appears, pictures, pictures, pictures. And that's why I say it's too bad we have to depend on audible vocal communication. We should have evolved to the point of transmitting by pictures by now. It's a shame. And we've gotten lost along the way. Often before I learned, did I wonder whence came the multitude of pictures that thronged my dreams, for they were pictures, the like of which I have never seen in real wake-a-day life. They tormented my childhood, making my dreams a procession of nightmares. Sanity, Jordan asserted, depended on bringing the various elements of racial memory and self-acquired thoughts together as one force. The atavistic dreamer finds cohesion when he discovers evolution in college, the explanation for his dreams. What if racial memories and self-acquired thoughts never emerged in the atavist dreamer? London explored this very question in his short story When the World Was Young, written in 1910. When the book was young is the story of a wealthy Bay Area businessman, James Ward, whose metamorphosis into an ancestor of the Vikings. Unlike the dreamer in Before Adam, the racial memories in When the World Was Young leap from the dream world into reality. On any given evening, the usual staid Ward romps from the forested glens of his palatial estate, clothed in animal skins, while he yells ancient Teutonic phrases by some quirk of atavism, London wrote. A certain portion of the early self's language had come down to him from racial memory. His barbaric self emerges at often inopportune times. He was not a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. His two personalities just never joined. Jordan stressed that the mind only functioned with a unified ego, Jordan wrote. Well, I think that's it for today. And I hope I'm not boring you with this, but it's very important, especially for you people out there who do think. They've tried to eliminate the idea of Aryan from our vocabulary and from our knowledge, and we know it's not true. Aryan is very real. And everything that is bad that's happened to us has come about by denying survival of the fittest and might is right. And the whole idea of rights and so many things that have been introduced to our society is destroying not only our race, but all races. And it's almost like a conspiracy, and maybe it is, I got my rights and all that kind of nonsense, and in religion, which has been even really in the foremost weapon to destroy our race. And that's what we got to understand. We got to retrace our steps and get back on the tracks. Okay, 14:5. In five words, I have nothing to say.
His people from monstrous giants. He was the idol of Vikings and barbarians in the darkest age ever known to man. But few know the reality behind his myth. He battled the ancient world's most colossal sea monster. And he was the last hope for Europe's pagans as they defied the armies of Christendom. Fact and fiction collide in the myth of the mighty Thor. Two arch enemies battle to the death. Thor, the thunder god, against a staggering beast. A giant snake who strikes with lethal force. It is man versus monster. Thor unleashes his deadliest weapon, lightning from his magic hammer, as thunder rocks heaven and earth. The myth of Thor is filled with these epic showdowns, heroic battles against creatures who threaten mankind.
Thor is the champion of the gods. He's the great fighter who can be brought out when something is really bad. You don't go to Thor for wisdom. Go to Thor because he's going to protect you against the evil monsters.
Tales of Thor's adventures provided escape from one of the bleakest periods in human history, the Dark Ages of the first millennium AD. It was a time when the Norse world, stretching from the British Isles to the Baltic Sea, was in turmoil.
It's an agricultural society where people were farming and surviving kind of at the very edge of how it was possible to survive because it was cold. It was the northern part of Europe. It wasn't around the Mediterranean where it was much easier to grow things. And it tended to be, from everything we can tell, quite violent.
War, famine, and death were daily facts of life on the desolate northern fringes of Europe. But the myth of Thor brought a sense of order to the chaos.
It was a religion of the countryside. Paganism actually is a Latin word that describes that, what the country people believe in. And paganism is not really well organized either. It's not like the Greek pantheon in the sense that it's very well organized and everybody knows whose responsibilities and who's more important than whom. It's very different.
The view of human life in that mythology was a fairly dark, a fairly stern one. Human beings didn't look forward to the kind of salvation in heaven at the end of time that's promised in the Christian stories. They had a kind of a darker, a more sorrowful view of life. People have to show great courage and hardiness in the face of enormous obstacles.
For inspiration, the people looked to Thor.